Hey everyone, welcome to Thrive with Asbury Seminary. I'm your host, Wes Wilcox, and on today's show we have Mary Ann George. Mary Ann is a singer, songwriter, and worship leader who is passionate about encountering the Lord. You might know her from Maverick City, who she has written and recorded with and toured with, or from her beautiful solo EP, Not Just Stories, that was released in 2021. We talk about her musical journey, how she joined Maverick City, and about the creation of her solo album. It was a fun conversation that I know you guys are going to enjoy, so let's listen. Hey, Mary Ann, thank you so much for joining us today.
So good to be here. Thank you for having me.
I've been looking forward to this conversation, So I'm glad that it's worked out. So tell me, as we get started here, when and how did you know that you had fallen in love with music? When did that happen for you?
Oh yeah, I've been in a musical family pretty much my whole life. So grew up with, my parents were both worship leaders. My dad played guitar. My mom didn't play any instruments, but my aunts and uncles did. And we always played music, whether there was like some sort of family event, get together, there's always an element of like music and more specifically worship. And so I kind of like had no choice in the beginning. I had to figure it out and kind of go into it. And my parents signed me up for violin when I was like four.
Oh, wow.
Since like 4 years old, I had been playing violin. That was like my first ever instrument. And then I went on to compete with violin and was classically trained. And I did all that. And then I learned by ear. I played guitar and piano, and so I just kind of like naturally had this affinity for picking up sound and sonics and music and, you know, learning new instruments. So it's kind of like been for as long as I could really remember, and all my cousins play instruments, and so I think my family put a very heavy emphasis on, you know, learning some sort of instrument. Practice a lot of discipline. I don't know. They just really pushed us to do that. And so for as long as I can remember, that's kind of part of what my DNA.
That's like, amazing. Yeah. That's really cool. My family, a lot of musicians in my family as well, so I can understand some of that.
Yeah.
So did they suggest violin to you, or was that something that you were like, I want to play
violin?
No,
I don't think I even knew. They did put, I mean, it's so funny, though. Violins are like so tiny.
Yeah, when you're 4 years old, they have to be pretty small.
But they invested in, you know, getting some teachers for me. And no, I didn't really I didn't really know. In fact, like, I think about my time and all the, as I got older, like, you know, being part of school and stuff, I hated it. I didn't like it. I've come to really appreciate it more in the last 10 years than I felt back then. I didn't feel the same.
Yeah.
So I love it. I love it a lot more now. But no, it wasn't an instrument that I had chosen to play. My parents kind of like saw the impact of classical music on the brain and probably wanted, they were like, all the smart people in the world, let's listen to classical music and love playing music. So orchestral music. So yeah, I don't think I don't think I had a choice in the matter. Yeah. It was really just what they made me play.
But it was always, music was something that you always enjoyed.
Yeah.
And so did they force you to like sit down and practice, or was it kind of just like you were self-motivated to learn things?
I think with violin, it felt more forced. But then when I started picking up, like, I remember my dad showing me a few basic chords on guitar. And, you know, when you play guitar, there's like certain strumming pattern that really, how you strum really matters. It's something you kind of just pick up naturally. It's a rhythm, like a natural rhythm that you respond to physically. And so when I picked that up, I think that's when everybody started to realize, oh, like, she kind of like has this ear for it. Then I taught myself piano. And what's funny is I can't, even to this day, if you ask me what notes I'm playing, this is actually embarrassing, but if you ask me what notes I'm playing on piano or guitar, I cannot tell you. I can tell you like based on numbers, which is, there's something called the Nashville number system. It's kind of like a universal language for bands. And I can tell you in that way, but I can't give you the actual number, like the names of notes I'm playing. So A, B, C, all the way to G. I can't tell you what they are, but I feel like, you know, that was something I picked up pretty quickly with my ear. It came a lot more naturally to me, and I think I enjoyed that part because no one told me to do it. That was something I kind of learned, whereas the violin was more of like, you got to practice. We're paying for these teachers. You know? So I think I discovered that I loved music a lot more once I started picking up on it my own. And very early on in high school and middle school, I was kind of producing my own things, learning how to do things myself. So I had this energy to learn, like, how to create music. And I think that's where the love of it really started to grow for me a lot more.
Yeah, that's very cool. Yeah, I know when an instrument becomes something that you can be self-motivated, that's when things really take
change.
Off.
Yep.
So,
yep.
Yeah, that's cool. How I feel. Do you play a lot of the instruments on your record?
No. So, no, I didn't. Okay. I was really nervous and a little insecure to do that because of my lack of knowledge on the thing, like just notes. Mm-hmm. And plus, we had some amazing band members playing on that record. So I just trusted them, and I felt like, you know, they can communicate exactly what I want to say the way that it needs to be said. But a lot, in all of the writing for the album, I did play, like, for those original. I did, like, play stuff on guitar and piano when we were building the songs. And so, but I want to say that in the future, I want to try to, like, do more of that, like, and connect to that instead of being afraid of it. So I'm challenging myself to kind of go more in that direction now.
Yeah.
But no, unfortunately, I did not.
Well, that's a good challenge for future projects, for sure. Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk about your career as worship leader, singer, all the things that you do. And a question that I have a lot for folks who do what you do, where do you find the balance between the performance side of what you do and the worship side? Because I would assume frequently, or maybe all the time, you're leading people in worship.
Right.
Where do you set kind of that line? Because it is still performance. There is that element. So what does that look like for you?
So I think it really does depend on what I'm singing. So, like, when it comes to doing, like, a worship event, I don't see it more of a performance. I see it more of, like, a partnership. Because I do think there's an element of, like, when you're leading worship, sensing the room and sensing, you know, the people around you and how they're responding. Now, that shouldn't dictate what you do, but it's good knowledge to know, like, how are people responding to a specific song. Like, that's why, you know, sometimes you'll go to worship events or, you know, where the artist will kind of sing one song for like 15, 20, 30 minutes.
Yeah.
And it's great. It's amazing because they're picking up on what the room and the heartbeat of the people are wanting to sing or wanting to hear, or how, you know, what that person that's leading is also sensing in the spirit of what God wants to do. And so I think when it comes to worship, it's kind of a little bit of a partnership between the Lord and you and God, kind of trusting you to relay this message to his people. But also there's a bit of, like, understanding the burden, the heart, and the need of the people that are in the congregation, that, you know, what do they need to hear as encouragement that may not be worship yet, but, like, what do they need for encouragement to get them to that place of worship, right? So to me, that feels more partnership than performance. But when you come to, like, if we're talking about just performing, because there is an element of what I do that is performance, it's less, you know, if I'm not singing a worship song, really, if there's nothing that's vertical about what I'm singing, to me, it's not worship, in my opinion. That's just my opinion. But there's a space for devotional songs. There's a space for faith-based music. There's a space for, you know, music that documents kind of like the Psalms and, like, what David is doing there, like, with just his personal process. I think there's a space for that. And so when it comes to that, I see that's more to me like performance a little bit of kind of like me expressing to you what I'm feeling. But I also see that as conversation. And I look at that as like letting you into my process and what I'm feeling. And hopefully you can relate. It's sharing a story. It's storytelling. And so I think there is a balance. It's knowing what you're going for. Like for today, you know, I'm here at the seminary and we're doing a chapel tonight and it's going to be worship. And I don't look at it as a performance, really. I see it as this I get to experience what God is doing on the campus and in the seminary, and I get to also hear the stories of the people and sense that in the spirit, but also kind of share what I feel like God has put on my heart for this university and the seminary. And so I see it that way. And I think it's just knowing when you walk into rooms or walk onto stages, like, what you're there for, what you feel like the mission is, what the vision is. It's always going to be to glorify God, yeah. No matter what the song is, really. Yeah. It's going to always be that. But just kind of knowing the expression and how to move from there, I think is just sensitivity to that is really important. And I think once you know that, you can kind of gauge and balance and know your place and know where you fit into the ultimate picture of what God is doing in a place. So,
yeah. That makes sense. So did you have any mentors, or how did you grow as a worship leader?
Oh, wow. No. I mean, when you consider mentors, I think growing up in the local church, I think, was a big part of it. I grew up in a predominantly Indian church that was pretty charismatic. And so, you know, they were very open to learning to sense the Holy Spirit in a room and, like, learning to gauge and discern what needs to be said, what needs to be sung. So there was a lot of safety and space in that setting for me to kind of make mistakes, but also to learn and grow. And I don't know that there was always one specific person. I think when I think about my journey in worship, I think about the people above me that were leading at my church that I kind of watched over time, just leading, but also just big movements at the time. Like, I was really influenced by like Hillsong and Bethel Music and just the way that they would lead worship with this freedom. I was so drawn to that. Darlene Sheck was a huge influence for me, you know, back when I was in grade school. Just seeing a woman leading was just such a big deal. So even just those ways, I think from afar there were a lot of mentors that, you know, maybe to this day don't know that they were such big influences on me. But then up close, just people living their life pretty authentically. I think when you think of the best worship leaders or the people in our lives that lead worship, they're really authentic and they're really true to who they are and they're really true to the call on their life. And I look at someone like a David, who God calls as a man after his own heart. Doesn't mean that he was perfect, but I'm really inspired by his life because he invited God into every part of his life. And I think I aim to do that, even the stuff that's hard, you know. I really want to be able to do that. And so those type of mentors and influences, I think, fuel my heart for what I hope my ministry is for people, or what I hope my ministry does for people. You know, I hope it spurs people to you know, be authentic and honest in their faith.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that authenticity, that is very powerful and very true for worship leaders. And in our team at my church, that's something we talk about a lot, is authenticity and what does that look like for us as a team and that sort of thing. So, yeah, I relate to that a lot. And kind of talking also in the same thing, as an artist, as a songwriter, performer, you're putting yourself fully into whatever you're creating, right, whatever you're performing in your worship leading. How do you keep your identity from getting wrapped up in what you do and in your art, and keep that grounded in who you are in God?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great question. There's so many ways I can answer this because I feel like this is going to be a lifelong question for me. But, well, one thing is I do feel like I am a strong believer that my life is my art. Like, the way I live is also art. And it's a call to worship also. So I look at it all kind of symbiotically together. But it is very easy to lose your identity in this and to think that, oh, you know, my sole existence on earth is to be a songwriter and a singer and an artist. And I don't necessarily mean it like that. And I don't mean that life is art in the sense that life is music. That's not what I mean. But I mean that, like, everything I do, even the way that I mother my daughter, even the way that I'm a daughter to my parents, even the way that I'm a wife to my husband, even the way that I'm a student of the gospel, like, in all of those ways, art is being infused into everything that I do and every role that I play. You know, so much of my identity isn't just locked into this thing that I do on stages. Like, when I've started viewing my life as art, like I started to see so much more color in everything else I'm doing, and how there's not just Marianne the artist. That's just one color of what I'm doing, but mm-hmm. there's actually this whole range of, there's a whole color wheel of things that make up me. And I think when I shifted that perspective, that greatly, greatly helped me, and saw that you know, God, the roles that I play publicly are just like maybe not even 5% of who I am in private. And so I've learned to also with the help of great community and support, because I have some. My parents will tell me very straight up to my face if I'm doing something. I mean, I'm South Indian, so they're very blunt. And having that is also very helpful, because they are not fazed by anything I do publicly. They don't know much about. Now, if I was a doctor or an engineer, it might have been a different story. But because I'm doing music, they can't really relate to any of my world. So they're very, very upfront and candid with me, being like, I don't really think this is cool. I don't like it. I don't like this. And I'm like, I've worked so hard on it. Yeah. I just don't like it. But even just having that kind of community and support that bring you down and be like, remind you that, hey, you're not just, this is just 1% of what you do. This is just 5% of what you do, whatever it is. Like, there's more to you than just this. And so I think surrounding myself with that, having that perspective change of like, you know, there's more to me than just an artist, you know? My whole life is a masterpiece of what God's doing, and the music is just one part of it and yeah. one avenue of it. So I think that perspective change and having that kind of support with my friends and my family are great. I still go to my home church, which is really humbling. Yeah. You know, humbling in the sense that, like, I remember where I came from, you know, mm-hmm. like in that way.
So, do you ever lead at your home church?
I do lead there. Okay. I do lead there. It's been different because when I left, it was pre-COVID, but the church has changed so much. I mean, we were originally a predominantly Indian church, and we had a name that was kind of like, it was called India Pentecostal Assembly. And so it was like really just catered towards Indians, but now, like, since I've come back, they've changed the name of it. It's been way more open to the community, so it's a whole different experience than what I grew up in. Nonetheless, I think it's great. It's been really great to see kind of how different things are and how my worldview on has changed. Also, being away and then being part of a really yeah. massive movement, and kind of coming back to everything, getting back to the basics and the roots of where it all kind of began. So. Yeah, I do lead there.
Yeah, that's cool. And I'm sure it's good to have that grounding when mm-hmm. you're off mm-hmm. tour and mm-hmm. in that hectic mm-hmm. lifestyle, and then coming back to something that you're very familiar yeah. with people who know you.
Who know me, that's, right. Yeah. Invested in me outside of what I do
yeah.
for a living. So.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your album. Came out in 2021.
Yeah.
And we were talking before we started filming that you started working on this in 2020. So tell me how the pandemic either influenced the creation of the album or any challenges that came about from that and what that process was like.
Yeah, so this album that I released, it was an EP, it was my debut, anything that I had done. But I was so new to the music industry. I didn't know anything about recording an album. I didn't know anything about, you know, how I wanted to do it, or I just knew that when I was a kid, I always wanted to record an album, and I really wanted it to be good quality out. I didn't want it to feel very cheap, which creating anything that feels like good quality is often very expensive. It's not cheap. I did not want it to sound, because there are avenues that you can go like a little bit more like B or C list, you know, and it can sound, it can be an album, but it won't sound like what you're listening to on radio. Just the quality of the sound is not going to be the same. And I was such a stickler for, even growing up, just what good sound, like good production, what that sounded like. I was so adamant about, I didn't want this to sound. I didn't want my name attached to something that felt like yeah. very mid quality. I was like very, I had this drive for excellence. And so I remember praying kind of as a kid, being like, I want to do this, but I don't want to do it the way that the people I know in my life have. And these were artists and people that I loved, but I just felt like because they didn't have the avenues, they didn't have the resources, the music that they had to create felt very mid quality, and I didn't want that. I wanted it to be really good quality. And so, you know, I walked into it when I did that in 20, I recorded the album in 2020 during the pandemic, which we'll get to. But I just knew that I wanted it to feel really good. And I was grateful that I got that, because I think that was something I really did not want to compromise. There was a lot about the album and, you know, the way that it was done that I didn't really have a say. I didn't know enough to have a say in. It was just such a last minute kind of thing. And thankful for Treble Records for kind of taking a chance on me and doing that, because I was a new artist on the scene. Nobody knew me at all. They just saw me with Maverick City, which was the group that I kind of came up with. And so, you know, they took a chance on me and gave me this opportunity. And I think it was just me not knowing how I wanted to communicate what I wanted at the time. So the album is so great. Like, it's just so great. But there were so many challenges in creating it, especially during a pandemic. I mean,
yeah, I'm sure.
When we recorded that album, we were doing this thing. We called it the two-week bubble, where we basically had there was 2 weeks. So the first week, there was like there was a certain amount of people that came. And mind you, we had to be quarantined for a week before we went or something. And then we had to like get a test and then come here, retest. And that's how we got ourselves in, but we had to wear masks. It was just like,
oh yeah,
the most crazy thing, because we were all together, like, and we had to contain. So they had 1 week of one slew of people, and then the next week it was a new group of people, but they were just back to back. And
oh, wow.
So in that time, they recorded my album, which in retrospect, I probably would never do that again. Yeah. in that kind of setting. I wanted it to feel like its own thing, but I understand why it was done. I understand why it was the way it was. But yeah, that was a big, big challenge, because it was a risk to do that and to do it in that setting with those many people. If you look at the live videos, you'll see what it looked like. It was like there was a lot of people in that room, and at a time where we were not encouraged to be in rooms with that many people.
So did you have the songs written ahead of time, or were they written?
Yes, I forgot to mention that. Yes. So they were already kind of written during 2020. There was a lot of them that were written during 2020. Actually, all of them, I think, were written one of them was written in 2019, like June. And then I'm Gonna Worship was 2020, Altar was 2020, Not Just Stories was 2020. Everything else was written in 2020. 2019 to 2020.
Okay.
We wrote them all during the pandemic, most of them.
Yeah. Did you collaborate on a lot of them, or were a lot of them just you?
On the singing or the writing?
Oh, the writing.
Yeah, everything was collaborated. I didn't, I actually had just started learning to co-write in 2019. And I found it to be such an awesome experience. Like, I enjoyed co-writing so much. I felt like it was ministry in a lot of ways. I felt like it was partnership. It was gospel. It felt just sharing stories. And I really loved the fact that, you know, people's cultures were different from mine. I felt like I'd grown up in this little bubble of, well, no pun intended, because it was recorded in a bubble. But I grew up in this little bubble or box of what I thought faith to be. And, you know, to hear some of the stories of the people that I wrote these songs with. One of them is, his name is Mitch Wong. He's also Asian American, half white, half Asian. But just hearing his stories, he grew up in Australia. And I loved collaborating with him. I collaborated with another one of my co-mates in Maverick City. His name was Dante Bowe. We wrote a lot of the songs on the album together, and, you know, he's a ministry kid too, grew up in ministry, and I just so enjoyed collaborating and together. I always believe that there's more power together than there is apart. So yeah. The things we were able to say and the stories we were able to communicate together in the writing, I think, is infused in every line of the song. And so I find that the more people involved in creating the story, the more people it touches, because they see themselves in it.
That's true, yeah. And that's interesting, because I know for some artists, co-writing is a mm-hmm. hard thing.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. if you want to talk just a little bit about it,
yeah.
what does a co-write look like?
Oh, yeah. Of course. I would love to talk about that. I feel like a lot of people don't know because I didn't know. But typically we'll like get into a room kind of like this one, actually. We'll just I don't like more than four people, but 3 to 4 people, sometimes more. There's usually an instrument in the room. Maybe one of the people is a producer, but we'll come in the room and one of the things we'll say, well, if we don't know each other already, we'll kind of have to share our stories. It's a very vulnerable experience. It feels like group therapy for everybody.
Yeah.
It feels like the whole session is group therapy. But we'll share our stories. We'll share like our testimonies. We'll share a little bit about, how we got to where we are. And co-writing is a very vulnerable experience. So it's like we kind of had to get deep real quick. And so we get into the room, we kind of share those things, and then we'll be like, well, what do you feel like God wants to say through you or through your life or through your testimony or through your story? And I think we'll all sense a common theme, like, okay, I'm sensing faithfulness, like I'm sensing this idea of faithfulness. Or sometimes people will come in with an idea, which they already have. Like I just went to a writing session yesterday where I had an idea and I kind of came into the room with this melody and a hook of some sort, like a little tag of something. That'll happen too. Or somebody will have a verse that they feel really heavy and we'll kind of like build off that idea. And sometimes we'll have like, you know, a producer will already have tracks created sometimes that they were thinking of. So it's mm-hmm. just collaboration. And then if we all feel really good about one of them, we'll kind of chase that down. And if that doesn't feel good, we'll kind of give it some time. Sometimes, you know, writing sessions are hours long. Like, I mean, when we wrote Not Just Stories, which is the single off of my EP, I think we were in that room for 6 to 8 hours. Like, we didn't leave. We were in that room for, like, 6 to 8 hours. And it was pretty tiring. We were like, if you look at that song, it basically tells the gospel in the song. It talks about some of the miracles Jesus did and how they're not just stories, they're truth. And but we were sitting there with our Bibles, like, what stories can we talk about? What's gonna fit here? Like looking at every like little miracle and every little thing that Jesus did and kind of putting it to song. A lot of times it helps to be a theologian when it comes to songwriting. At least for worship, it really helps because there's just so much to say. So sometimes those writing sessions take a long time. Sometimes we get in the room and we're just not vibing or we're not feeling it. There needs to be this synergy that everybody has. And sometimes it doesn't happen, you know. In that case, we'll kind of like, we'll just like talk and catch up and chill and maybe not put so much pressure to create something and let it naturally happen. Maybe in like a week or two, somebody will text the group chat and be like, hey, you know, I know we didn't finish the song, but like I had this idea. What if we did this? And then send a voice note. A lot of times songs are written on voice notes and via text.
So I want to talk a little bit about the sound of your album, because you mm-hmm. talked about how that was so important to you. And that was something that stood out to me as I listened to it, was just the feeling that it feels very in the moment mm-hmm. and almost like a live recording. Mm-hmm. And I wondered a couple of times, I was like, did y'all record this at a show? Like, so, so how did you get the sound that you wanted and what was that process?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a live recording, actually. There wasn't a lot of people. It wasn't a live recording in the sense that there were people watching us. Mm-hmm. There were people, if you look at the music videos for my EP, you'll see people in the background singing with me. So those were kind of like the people worshiping with me, if you want to say. Okay. But it was all recorded live, not in a studio setting. It was recorded live. But I had Aaron Moses, who was playing keys on it. He kind of arranged a lot of it very in the moment, really. So it felt very in the moment. And I'm actually glad that was communicated, because I do feel like that's such a big part of the sound of the album, just like the level of expertise and genius that it takes to create something that quickly in that mm-hmm. moment and kind of feel, because I do think there's this palpable purity that you can sense in the album to this day that I think makes the album stand out in my opinion. Like, I just love that you can sense the purity on it. And I think that is something I didn't necessarily plan for. Like, I think I just went into it because I was so fresh and so, like, new to the whole world. I came in with this really doe-eyed idea of, no, I don't even want to say doe-eyed, because I do think it was really beautiful. Like, you know, I don't think I was naive. I don't want it to come off like I came into this, like, naive. But I walked into it really with this, like, 10, 15 years of, like, my journey with God, and now I get to share it with the world and tell the world about, you know, me and Jesus and how we've kind of talked to each other and the things that I've learned along the way. And so it was just that purity, I think, is sensed in the sound. And I love that it is there in the arrangements as well. Like, and so I did fight for that. Like, I think me not knowing as much helped with the sound of it, because I wanted it to feel very, very pure and very in the moment and very organic. And I think that is communicated, if I'm being honest. I think that is communicated in the album.
It definitely is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. And going back to what you had talked about with authenticity, that's the way that album feels. It feels authentic. It doesn't feel overproduced. Yeah. It just feels like you and the group that was with you, and and I thought that struck me the most listening to it, just the sound of it. But I loved a lot of the songs on that. It was
thank you so much. Good. I'm so glad. Yeah. I'm so glad it's still touching people.
Yeah,
it feels like an ancient album now. Just kidding. It's just 3 years old.
Yeah, well, but it just turned 3 years old. Yeah. Sometimes they feel very short, and sometimes they feel very long
last
couple of years. So some people might know you from Maverick City.
Yeah.
So how did you get involved with them? And can you tell us what is Maverick City?
Yeah. So I was doing music, as I said, in my local church. And I, you know, we had social media that has been such a helpful tool for our generation just to do anything. So I was doing some covers on social media, and one of the covers I did was by a huge artist. Her name is Tasha Cobbs Leonard. She's a gospel artist, but I had gone to the Bethel Worship School that she had sang this song called This Is a Move At, and it hadn't been released yet. But that song was written in one of the first Maverick City music camps. So Maverick City started off as like a writing, kind of like a writing camp. And it was just co-founded by two people. Their names were Tony Brown and Jonathan Jay. And they were part of this big band called House Fires. House Fires is most popularly known for Good Good Father, the song Good Good Father, which Tony wrote. And they had this idea of, like, you know, Tony is half black, half white. And he didn't feel like there were many people in the music industry that were writing that could relate to him and his struggle with identity and, like, just not really fitting in either category of white or black, which is, like, if we're being very frank, it's like CCM and gospel, like, you know, and in that space. And so he had this idea of bringing together songwriters that were diverse and just kind of getting stories out and sharing each other's stories and creating new ones that felt really authentic to the widespread bunch of, like, races and cultures that were in the church. Like, he wanted to highlight that. And so he started these camps and kind of invited all these songwriters from different worlds to come together. And there was no name on it, but in one of those camps, Tasha Cobbs Leonard came, and she wrote this song with Brandon Lake and him and Nate Moore. It was called This Is Move, and it was such a great song, and she sang it at Bethel Worship School, and I was at Bethel Worship School that year. There was a lot of different, by the way, in this story, there's so many different avenues, and if I had to sit here and tell you how God kind of connected it all, we'd be here for hours, so I'm not going to go into all of that, but this is one of the big ones. And so when I came back home from that worship school, I was so moved by that song, and I did a cover of it on my Instagram page. And just like me worshiping, kind of just singing it, but I was told to tag the songwriters so they could see it. And I was like, I don't really want to do that. I just did it anyway. I was just like, okay, well, just anyway, Tony found that video and immediately messages me. He's like, hey, do you like write music? And I was like, I mean, I write, like, I feel like I'm not a songwriter. I feel like I could maybe do some melodies, not really songwriting. And he's like, no, I think you have it. Like, I think you have something special. Like, I would love for you to come to one of our camps. And at that time, it was like a invite only thing. Like, it wasn't public. And I was like, sure. I mean, I don't know you. So I don't know. maybe like in the future, I don't know. But I kept doing these covers, and he had followed me and kind of was keeping track of my music at that point. And then Chandler Moore is one of the like faces of Mav City now. And at that time, though, he had written this song called Isaiah Song, which was another song I like felt really connected to. And so I did a cover of that, and he found that and was like, can you come to my church and sing this song for our album? And I was like, absolutely, like, sure. And I go to that was in 2019. January, I go to Chandler's church. I ended up meeting Tony there because Nate was actually singing on that same album. And so, yeah, I met all of them at that point. Like, Dante, Aaron were there, Alton, Eugene, who was one of the original members of the group. All Tony, Nate, like, they were all there. And I kind of he explained this idea of Maverick City. And I don't know if he even used the name at the time. I think he just said, we're just a group of songwriters. I would love for you to come June, July, and August. We're having camps. And I was like, cool. I had just graduated with my master's in 2018 in December. So I was taking my time to just start looking for jobs, doing my board exams, kind of applying for licensure to practice. And so I was like, okay, like, maybe we'll see. I go to these camps, ended up loving it. Actually, that first ever co-write that I did was the song You Have My Yes on my album.
Wow.
First ever, yeah. Which was a really big full circle moment for me to have it on the album, and it was my first ever write.
Yeah.
But yeah, and so that was like when I just started to do things with the group. And I think by that June camp, they had named it Maverick City, and they'd started to like get gear up for a release of Volume 1. We didn't know at that time it was gonna be anything. I think we were just recording songs because we wrote them and we thought they would be cool to record. Yeah, but by Volume 3, I think I featured on that one. I can't remember if I was on Volume. I was like helping with BGVs on the second album. But I think by the third album I was on it, leading a song. I think I led one song. But yeah, it kind of just took the world by storm. I made the decision to go full time with music in November of 2019. After those three camps, I had another camp in November, and I made the decision to kind of go full time right before that. And yeah, it's kind of just been this really beautiful, crazy, wild journey adventure since then. The COVID hit right after, so that was crazy. But yeah. It's been a wild ride since then, and Mav is still doing their thing. I've kind of taken a step back to focus more on my solo career, because I really feel led to do that right now. And but man, it's been a really wild journey, like, for us as a whole group. It's so beautiful. I still love that group so much. I still love the artists in it, and it'll always be a big part of me.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah, it'll always be such a big part of who I am, and I'm so grateful for the lessons we've learned along the way.
Yeah.
It's really big.
That's cool. And that's a crazy way that all came about.
Right. It's so wild. Just, every time I tell the story, I'm always just like, this really is like a really crazy story.
But that's very awesome. So I want to back up a little bit because you mentioned your master's degree.
Oh, yeah.
And so you have a master's in clinical mental health counseling.
Yeah.
So before all the stuff with Maverick City, mm-hmm. was your plan to be a therapist?
Yes.
And that was going to be what you did?
I had a plan to do therapy and kind of work in a private practice of some sort, or do like work in an organization that focused specifically on women and children. I had this desire to really work with survivors of sexual assault and violence and domestic violence, and I had a desire to work in that population. And so I'd always wanted to kind of do that. My ultimate dream would have been to combine some sort of musical element in there. But I had
I would have had to go into further training, I think, at that point, which I'm not sure that I wanted to do. And I mean, all my plans kind of derailed at that point when I got into the music. But I really feel like it was supposed to happen. Looking back on it now, I still use my counseling skills almost every day, like in writing sessions in rooms with people.
I was going to ask you about that. And like, mm-hmm. and as you're touring, even mm-hmm. within yourself to kind of mm-hmm. deal with mm-hmm. what life is like now.
Yeah, it's such a different, I still see a therapist. I'm always pro therapy. I'm always pro like getting mental help and mental health taken care of. And I need it for myself just to balance a lot of the things that I'm dealing with. And so, but yeah, like I do find that I'm also able to be a good advocate for people, you know, in this space, because a lot of people in this industry that I'm in are not doing well, not doing well emotionally. It's just a lot to carry and to handle. You know, even in the Christian space, it's just hard to like the pressure. I think it's often worse in the Christian space because of that pressure to, you know, the standard that people have for them. And, you know, I think oftentimes Christian music artists are put on these pedestals and expected to live perfect lives. And they're really just human. They're, you know, we're all just trying to make it and survive. And a lot of times the attack on them spiritually, but also just like amongst their own, our own peers and people is just a lot. And so, you know, I always try to be very sensitive to that when I'm in rooms with them. And I do feel like the counseling skills come out a lot more, you know, when I'm working in this space. I find myself using it a lot. So, yeah, that was my plan. That was originally my plan, to work in some sort of practice or, you know, working with an organization and, you know, doing therapy. But that, I'm so glad that I actually did get my master's, and I'm one of the few, I don't find a lot of people in my industry who've actually gone on to grad school and who have come, who've come to do music afterwards, you know, because it is a more risky career move. To do anything music related or entertainment is just a risk. You know, it's just fickle. But, you know, seeing how my degree has kind of impacted the way that I write songs and write music and the way that I move around in this industry, in this field, I'm really grateful to have had that in my back pocket.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's very cool. Yeah, because when I saw that, I thought, well, that's different. Yes. You don't usually see a professional musician who has that in their background. Yeah. So that's very cool. So what's coming up next for you?
Yeah, so kind of just been really messing with the idea of putting out some sort of content. Now, I don't know what that looks like yet, but I really enjoy stories, and I've had an idea of putting together a book of some sort, which is something like a coffee table book of some sort. These are like really top secret things that I've not shared with the world. But I would love to do that. That's one. And two, I am still working on music. I'm forever working on music. But whatever next body of work I put out is going to be very different from the one that I already released. So it's not going to be as worship heavy. It'll be a little bit more faith. It'll be faith-based, but more process and kind of me documenting some of my stories in motherhood and life, love, kind of navigating this whole like industry, some of the feelings associated with that. I think that all of that is going to come on my next album. Whenever that is, we'll see. But I have plans on, I don't think, I definitely have a plan to release songs. So we'll see when it comes up. I'm not putting pressure on myself to do that either. I think there's still a bit more life left to live, to birth the songs that I want to say, sing. So, but, another thing that I'm going to start doing is some live shows. So I have a few live shows slotted up that haven't been announced yet, which is also top secret.
Oh, okay.
But we are doing a live show in New York City next month.
Nice.
I haven't announced it yet, but it's going to come out. Consider this the official announcement. Wow. On the Asbury podcast. Very cool. But yes, we're actually securing a venue right now. So we are on par. We're like on track to be doing the show next month. So that's exciting. I've never done my own solo show, which is going to be really fun. Solo show in the sense that I am like advertising I'm doing. I've done a lot of bookings or like go to events and I'll be the artist that's like highlighted. But this is like my first like debut show that I'm doing. So kind of marketing it more of like an experience, less of a show, not just a show. That was like one of the joke titles we named it because it's not just stories, not just a show. But that's not actually what it's called. But it's just going to be a real experience, which I'm really excited for people to go come and experience that with me. It's going to be great.
Yeah,
so I'm going to do a few more of those and kind of get more comfortable with the performing element of what I do, because so much of what I've been doing is worship. So this will be more of like, hey, like friendship talk, like storytelling. I'm really excited for that. It's going to be so good.
Well, we'll be looking forward to that, and I know our audience will be, and we'll be looking forward to whatever music comes out next as well.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and so to close, we have one question that we always close with. So this is the Thrive with Asbury Seminary podcast, and we like to ask, what is one thing in your life right now, or maybe more than one, but one thing that's helping you thrive right now?
Oh, it could be anything.
Anything.
Okay, this is going to be a really dumb answer, but not eating fried food
it's
such a game changer for me. I had such great, when you eat like clean food, it really just, I feel it's a difference between living and thriving to me. Yeah. Like clean food, like fresh ingredients, just like adding the spices to it, obviously, because I'm brown, so we need to add a little bit of spice to it. But the flavor and letting those natural, organic vegetables just shine, like the taste, the flavor, all of it comes out. I feel like I'm thriving when I eat that food versus like a deep fried chicken tender. I can't do it. Like, yeah. So clean food. This is a very like probably simple answer, but.
No, that's awesome.
I feel like I'm thriving when I eat clean food.
Cool.
Or even like clean sushi. That's great too, right?
Good sushi. Very good.
Yeah. So that's awesome. My answer.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Marianne.
Thank you.
And we hope things go well tonight with the worship service.
Yes. So excited. Hope to see everyone there.
All right. Thank you.